You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on May 19th, 2015 from my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Nate joins me to discuss two big ideas for reforming American governance and the economy. First up, wage subsidies, based on an experiment in Mexico. Then, increasing the size of the U.S. House of Representatives. All that is coming up right now on Arsenal for Democracy. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Monday and is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me in studio, as usual, is Nate. Nate, welcome back.
Thanks, Bill.
All right, so the story that I want to start off with, we're doing basically another big ideas show, so all of our segments today are going to be related to sort of a big theoretical idea in politics or economics. The one we're looking at now is direct government wage support. So previously, I think we've done a couple segments, you know, about various social programs from the government or, you know, guaranteed income or reverse income tax, sort of those theoretical ideas. This is a much simpler proposal, but is one that seems very strange to us, which is basically the government just directly paying for part of, you know, the income for some of the sort of lower income tier jobs. So this basically stems from a story out of Mexico, actually. According to the Los Angeles Times, on May 14th, Baja California farm worker leaders and the Mexican government reached a tentative agreement Thursday that would boost wages and guarantee government-required benefits to thousands of laborers in an apparent breakthrough aimed at ending the nearly two-month-long labor dispute. This is that the federal government agreed to pay part of the workers' wages in order to meet their demands for a minimum daily wage of 200 pesos, or about $13. So obviously that's way lower than, you know, what we're used to in the United States, but at the prevailing rate, the labor movement has said that, you know, $13 would be livable for the day, you know, 200 pesos, that's their target. You know, and I think we've seen similar protests in the United States for trying to get a minimum wage closer to like $15 or something per hour, of course. But this is, you know, an alternative solution here. The federal government is apparently going to pay for it, but a lot of this was being negotiated by the state government in Baja California. But I wanted to kind of talk about this because this hasn't ever happened in Mexico before. And it hasn't happened in the United States. I mean, some people were pointing out that there are sort of indirect ways of subsidizing in the United States, like food stamps and Medicaid and things like that for sort of low income, you know, Walmart or McDonald's workers. There's been plenty of evidence on that. But the question is, should the government be picking up the tab for part of the income if it's at a minimum level? So Nate, I want to get your initial thoughts on this.
Yeah, I mean, this is a pretty interesting proposal that I've seen discussed elsewhere, but in maybe a more theoretical level. I'm not sure if it's necessarily been applied in too many other places, but I think a lot of economists like this idea more than simply jacking up the minimum wage because, well, I guess if you think about it, if you actually seriously increase the minimum wage rather than just subsidizing it, then you're sort of like affecting the labor demand of these various businesses. Like if maybe they were going to hire two more employees, but they can only hire one because they don't have the wages, I guess, to pay two more employees. I mean, it's all very margins and everything there. So it's a little difficult to concretely discuss, but it is, you know, it does put some inefficiency on the business. I mean, you know, that's not necessarily a mortal sin, but it's something that we can think about. And, you know, just in various economics books I have read, you know, they discuss that it might be a little more efficient to just simply pay the difference and, you know, indirectly subsidize minimum wage workers, but in a way that where the business is not necessarily impacted. So, I mean, it's an interesting idea. We'll have to see how it sort of works down there in Mexico. Apparently there are a couple different zones, and it will increase the minimum wage to third either a 67.29 Mexican pesos or 63.77 Mexican pesos. So this is ends up being around $5, you know, per day, the minimum wage. So obviously a little different in Mexico, different cost of living, different overall wealth of the nation. So it's not going to, it'd obviously be much higher here in the U.S. But it just, they're working on just trying to figure this out and see if it, if businesses embrace it, if, you know, the people embrace it, government embraces it, and it has some impact. I mean, maybe we should start looking at it, ideas like that here, where we're not necessarily, from the government's perspective, impacting actual economic transactions, but we are trying to find some way to support people. So, you know, it's trying to strike a balance between working within sort of economic orthodoxy, but at the same time also breaking that mold a little bit by actually saying, okay, we actually have a responsibility to these people that are earning minimum wage, that they can, you know, actually support themselves and their families. So it's important that we try to find a way to augment their income without necessarily affecting the labor market, which could potentially put some people out of work. So, you know, you just try to find a way to cause the most benefits in the system without actually producing anything that could potentially disrupt the labor market.
Right. I mean, there's, you know, a lot of this, again, as you said, until now has been sort of a theoretical discussion that, you know, various economists haven't been able to test this in the real world because nobody's really wanted to try it. And a lot of that, I think, is for political reasons, you know. But as you said, there's varying debates over, does, you know, unemployment rise with a minimum wage rise? And there's some evidence to say yes, some evidence to say no. That's something we've talked about previously on the show, the idea that sometimes it may end up being fewer jobs created, but they, because they pay more, people who work multiple jobs can now work, you know, one job or something like that. Right, so yeah. So there's not necessarily a one-to-one correlation between, oh, you raised the minimum wage this much,
right,
and therefore,
well, because this is
up,
like, yeah, obviously theoretical, operating in like a inelastic demand, you know, graph, and you're plotting everything out. It's like, okay, that's not how things actually operate in the real world. But, you know, when you think about the concepts involved, a business that has to pay its employees more might be less likely to hire a new employee. So, I mean, there's that. But if you're actually giving the business money and say, okay, hire as if you would normally, but we're just going to pay this person more because we don't think the current minimum wage is sufficient for people to live on, that's not going to affect that business's earning or hiring practices. So, you know, I'm sure they're not going to turn down the prospect of free money. So, I mean, this
right
potentially good.
And I guess it gets into some questions about, like, sort of reactions, unintended consequences, because that's hard to know as well. I mean, you know, one thing I was thinking of is, are there going to be some companies that try to then, you know, illegally pay less because they know that it'll end up being what it used to be because of that government subsidy? And I think it's hard to know for sure whether or not companies would do that. Apparently the government here, in the federal government in Mexico and the Baja government, are saying that they're going to negotiate some pretty strict rules to make sure that this isn't abused. And also they are, as I think Nate mentioned, going to raise the minimum wage a little bit too. So it's, you know, they're not having to pay, the taxpayers aren't having to pay purely, you know, the entire amount from versus what the wage is now to what it would be. You know, the companies are going to pay for some of it, and then the rest of the difference is going to be paid for by the government. I think the biggest sort of social criticism here, and this is the kind of big issue that I want to get into, is that, you know, is this essentially like corporate welfare or whatever, right? Is this like a taxpayer, you know, funded gift to these agribusinesses and stuff like that, that are really, you know, closely tied to the government? Like, that's a, you know, a thing I think to be concerned about. But then the sort of follow-up question to that is, well, even if it is that a reason not to do this? Because, as Nate said, you know, we have an obligation to make sure that people are getting paid a livable wage at sort of the bottom of the spectrum. And the thing that how I put it when I wrote about this in a post on arsenalfordemocracy.com is that there's sort of a difference at this point between how we might ideally want, you know, corporate responsibility to work or whatever versus what's actually realistic to achieve the goals, right? The goal is not to, you know, make the company pay more money. The goal is to get these people to have livable wages. So the question is, how do you realistically do that in the 21st century, when you have this globalized economy where you could just, you know, move the operations to a different part of Mexico or a different company or something like that, if you had just jacked up the minimum wage, right? So I think that, you know, this is potentially an answer. It might not be like the best answer, you know, in moral, abstract, ethical terms or whatever, but it seems like it's potentially, you know, a feasible answer, which honestly, at this point, feasibility is probably one of the most important criteria, right? The pie in the sky days are kind of over at this point. We've got to start thinking pretty seriously about this. So what, how do you react to that, the sort of social dynamic here of like, whose responsibility is it to, you know, pay for this? Like, because I think that's something that is going to concern a lot of people, that, you know, it's shifting it from the corporation's responsibility to the taxpayers.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that is a decent point. You just sort of wonder whether these corporations will necessarily be, you know, particularly interested in the workers' welfare, just if they're not prodded to in any way. So, I mean, it could end up being that, as you mentioned, Bill, the fact that they're getting paid rather than just sort of seeing their mandatory minimum wage, you know, sort of floor being jacked up, perhaps make them less likely to try to relocate their, you know, their fields or whatever businesses to a different part of Mexico, or obviously if we're talking about global context, different part of the world. That's perhaps harder in some circumstances. Like obviously, if you mentioned, you know, various field laborers, you know, it's kind of hard to move the specific fields. But if we're talking about a more potentially outsourceable job that could potentially do it somewhere else that doesn't have as high minimum wage, which has always been sort of the problem with minimum wage, is especially when you're talking about like U.S. manufacturing jobs. But yeah, you could potentially see something like that. Yeah.
The other thing that kind of struck me was that this seems so alien to us because we haven't done something like this in the United States of having the government just write a check for the difference, but it's not totally unprecedented in reality, because one of the things that we've seen that's been very controversial, certainly, but is a big feature now of a lot of the, you know, global marketplace, is this concept of incentives, right? So the government says, you know, if you move your operations to this location and you create, you know, this specific number of jobs, we'll give you this amount of tax breaks. And that can work out to a pretty serious amount of money. You know, I don't know exactly how much it would be relative to a plan like this, but, you know, in many cases, tens of thousands of dollars are being essentially awarded in tax breaks or tax cuts to companies in exchange for creating a specific number of jobs in, you know, Kentucky or Illinois or someplace, you know, very, like maybe even a specific city, because some of these are state programs, some of these are local community programs. So, you know, why is it that that is seen as, you know, a perfectly acceptable sort of hidden wage support, whereas this is kind of seen as something totally crazy?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's totally crazy. I guess it is a wage support, but it's not like it's so, you know, revolutionary, the idea. I mean, people are coming up with this idea before it's even implemented. It's pretty simple when you think about, okay, what are the downsides of minimum wage and what are the benefits? It's trying to split the middle here or sort of get the benefits without necessarily the downsides. So, as you mentioned before, I guess the worry could potentially be that we're shifting more of the burden onto the government now to provide for workers rather than necessarily the corporations. And, you know, we have seen a sort of degradation of the idea of, like, you know, the corporation should be like the family for the workers and provide all the necessary things for them. And now it's sort of just, you know, they've abrogated the responsibility a little bit. But I mean, that's also modern economics and modern capitalism, where it's not like it isn't a family, it's a business and you're going to run it like one. So you're not necessarily going to go out of your way for the workers. Unfortunately, that does shift a lot of the burden onto the government in terms of actually making sure that there aren't adverse outcomes to that. But you know, I think this is the right way to go in terms of striking a balance of trying to get the corporations involved in a positive way rather than sort of like lording these demands onto them to try to like make life better for the workers. But it could, you know, have adverse outcomes or just unintended consequences or just it's not achieving a level of cooperation necessarily. So, you know, this could potentially be a way of trying to try to ensure some cooperation at least.
Right. Well, on that note about cooperation, you know, one thing that I kept on thinking here is this seems like a pretty uniquely Mexican solution. Well, maybe not unique, but it's certainly a solution that you would expect to see coming out of Mexico, because the ruling party there now at the federal level, and previously they had been, you know, for seven decades or whatever, had been in power before there were sort of multi-party elections successfully. The PRI, the Institutional Revolutionary Party of Mexico, had this philosophy that was sort of tripartism was one word for it, and social corporatism. And so the idea of tripartism is basically you want to have cooperative negotiations between the private sector, the labor force, and the state. These are three entities and interest groups, essentially. They all have powerful roles in any sort of, you know, labor marketplace, whether it's, you know, setting the legal standards or actually giving the jobs or taking the jobs, right? Everyone has a role to play. So can you negotiate between these three factions, that's the tripartism part of that word, and, you know, have everyone come to a sort of negotiated solution like this, rather than having something that's either more adversarial or completely dominated by one of those three, right? You know, like a communist system is obviously theoretically dominated by just the workers, and a hardline capitalism one, right? That's going to be just pretty much, you know, no role for the state, no role for the workers as a collective. They're just individuals. And then
the state's evil, Bill.
Sure. And, you know, and then there's alternative various other systems, you know, fascism in particular, along with obviously communism in practice, where the state is sort of the big dominant force, and then everyone else is sort of, you know, pushed around
crushed
by
under
that.
Their boots.
Right. But yeah, like, so it seemed like a very Mexican idea to come up with this, of saying, you know, like, let's come up with a sort of a three-way solution, right? The labor people, they're going to get, you know, more money. They're going to get various other protections were going to be included in this deal. The government was going to prevent these strikes from happening. These were actually getting apparently pretty violent. I mean, they're, you know, not far from San Diego, you know, just across the border or whatever. Some of these things were starting to get very disruptive, you know, highways being shut down, things being set on fire, that kind of thing. And so this was, you know, potentially could have gone in a more violent direction if they had not started, you know, really thinking outside the box here for a solution. But yeah, I mean, it just like, this seems like something that Mexico would come up with, but then no one else is going to initially think, oh, this could also work for us. But I think, as you've been saying, like, maybe we do need to think about having it here, because it's not as crazy as it sounds, you know, just because we haven't done it before. As you said, people have been theorizing about this for quite a while. And the other thing that I was thinking about is, you know, like, industrial policy is probably basically never coming back, right? That's where the government is just directly subsidizing, you know, something like a manufacturing sector or whatever, or, you know, doing a New Deal style thing of just paying lots of people directly to do various jobs, right? That's sort of the bigger picture version of an industrial policy. You know, it's usually a little bit narrower than that, but kind of that sort of concept is probably not coming back in terms of advanced economies. This almost seems like a hybrid of saying, like, you know, okay, it's not going to be like a government owned sector or whatever. They're not writing the entire check or whatever, but they are, you know, essentially creating jobs. The money is going directly to the workers. You know, it's not like a tax break where the company is making the money and the corporations here. It's like a sort of corporate state policy where the corporations pay for the bulk of it, and then the state is paying for some of it, and then you've created these jobs and you've lifted people out of poverty, ideally. And I'm kind of thinking this, you know, this might be sort of the future direction here, because Nate alluded to sort of outsourcing and moving jobs around to various locations. I think, you know, we have to acknowledge that there is a global marketplace that's very flexible at this point. It's easy to move a lot of operations. I mean, even farm fields, right? You're not physically moving the field, but you could go plant something somewhere else and then just hire workers there. So I think almost everything at this point is movable. So it's sort of irrelevant at this point who's, you know, quote unquote, responsibility it is to pay for, you know, the keeping the workers you know, housed and fed and that kind of thing. It's like, it's everyone's responsibility. So we have to come up with some sort of a mixed solution, that does this, you know, achieves this goal. Cause it's that sort of industrial policy is not coming back. That sort of American model of the corporation is the family, like Nate was talking about, that's not coming back. How do you see this going into the future, sort of, you know, dealing with the realities of a globalized economy at this point?
Yeah, I mean, as we sort of talked about, it's important that we're not sort of just refighting the old battles of like the 60s and 70s to the point where, you know, we're sort of re-embracing the old left, quote unquote, and we're trying to, you know, pump money into these massive manufacturing, you know, ordeals. And things are very different now in terms of just the structure of the economy. So, you know, there aren't these massive manufacturing plants to sink money into in a lot of places. So you sort of wonder, okay, is this necessarily the most efficient way of going about trying to help out people that are, you know, struggling to make ends meet? But I think this idea actually is pretty good, because if you think about the amount of sort of service jobs there are now, and just like a lot of those are going to be paying at or around minimum wage. And those are a much larger percentage of the economy than they were even, you know, 30, 40 years ago. Then, okay, so we're actually going to be having an impact on much more people than we might have otherwise with like these sort of strictly targeted like steel manufacturing. Okay, let's go help out the steel man. Okay, well, how many people actually make steel these days? Okay, not too many. So you sort of have trying to find various ways of actually impacting the most amount of people, and this could be potentially an avenue. I'm not saying it's only way, but it's, you know, sort of a way to look forward to, or just an idea that's sort of reflective of what I think that sort of liberals need to do in terms of reconciling sort of their goals with various aspects of the global economy, not necessarily conceding to them, but not trying to, you know, just override them either. Sort of go with the flow, try to work within the system and not necessarily upset it, try to deviate. Okay, if we're talking about like a river as the capitalistic global economy, if you can try to deviate it or build a bridge or something like that, like, let's not try to like dig a whole nother river and canal off to the side or something. Let's actually try to be as constructive as possible. So that's sort of how I'm looking at things and trying to figure out ways of, you know, not necessarily upsetting things just to do that, just to like, okay, we hate capitalism, we hate corporate greed, let's, you know, try to disrupt the economy. No, let's actually try to find concrete ways to help people. And, you know, if it's not impacting the hiring practices of the businesses that we're going after, then that's probably better than doing so.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think like you were saying, this gets into a lot of those things that we talked about just last week when we were talking about the British elections, the old labor versus the new labor, right? That we're not saying that labor or the Democrats or whoever should concede and be, you know, the light version of the Republicans or the Conservative Party, right? You don't want just to be, you know, the right light party. Like, that's not what we want here. But we do need to acknowledge that at a minimum, the economic setup is completely different now, both on a national and global level. I mean, Nate was talking about all the service jobs. They're fairly low paying. I think, you know, in some areas, if not nationally, something like, you know, a quarter of all the quote unquote new jobs created since the end of the recession have been, or at least the lowest point in the recession have been those service jobs. I think, you know, places like Texas, especially, it's been very dominated by, you know, these service economy jobs. And you know, so that's not to say, oh, let's just adopt, you know, lighter versions of all the Republican policies. That's saying, okay, like, we need to rethink how we, you know, acknowledge the system that we are now operating within and come up with a different, tactic or toolbox to accomplish the same goals, right? I don't think the goals fundamentally have changed all that much for a, you know, traditional center-left party. Like, those are still valid goals. It's just, how do we get to those goals? And we've gotten a little bit too tied up and I think that's true for the Republicans too, right? So there's the Democrats maybe are tied up in specific, very narrow policy options that they think that I have to do this in order to get to that objective. And then I think there's the Republicans and even some of the new Democrats are a little bit too tied up in the, well, the only solution is creating jobs. And we've talked a little bit about, you know, it's a little bit more complicated than that. It's because jobs can go away. I mean, that's the you know, the other big problem here. Jobs aren't permanent. So how do you construct a system that works for everyone and is not dependent on either some, you know, massive permanent government program, or on the one hand, or on the other hand, saying, oh, all we have to do is just create X number of million jobs, because that may not be a viable solution either. So something like this is a more flexible, middle ground, pragmatic solution. It's not necessarily the ideal solution from a social standpoint, but it is a way of getting to that goal in the system that we have. And, you know, I think this is going to become an even bigger issue going forward, because, you know, we're seeing lots more mechanization, automation, you know, robotics are going to become a bigger thing. And like in the past, you know, you would automate something, but then that would free up another part of your labor force to do something else. And then that would generate a lot more productivity, right? And like you could kind of keep pace with it, right? If farm work got mechanized, that would free up farm workers to then go become industrial workers. But we may reach a point where the mechanization ends up just simply putting a lot of people out of work. And then we need to think about like, okay, well, where do we go from here, right? We got to make sure people are still fed, occupied in houses, that kind of thing. And something like this seems like a potential way of like subsidizing some of these goals so that you at least have people doing something and making enough money to survive. I think it's going to become, you know, more complicated than that. But I think like we need to start thinking much more outside the box than we have been. And this seems like a good starting point for that.
Yeah. And I think it's pretty important that we just sort of continue to explore these sort of economic trial ideas. So we're doing a little bit of experimenting, maybe on the smaller scale, obviously, the state, Baja. You know, it's on the smaller scale, but if it works out and other similar programs like this work out, then you could potentially start moving them to a larger scale and, you know, seeing what works. I mean, I think that's the important thing for states to sort of try things out in ways that could potentially benefit people. And, you know, if we're seeing the testing works well, then you could potentially scale it up.
All right, we are going to go to a break now, but we'll be back in just a few moments from arsenalfordemocracy.com and WVUD. So stick around. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still in studio with me is Nate. We want to move on now to our second big ideas topic on this week's episode. This is a more direct big ideas for reforming American governance, but potentially, you know, other countries' governance too, I guess. And this has to do with the ratio of voters to their representatives or in other countries, members of parliament, and how that affects the system, both, you know, bigger effect and also just how it would work in elections. So just to give a few statistics, right? The U.S. House of Representatives, back when it was started, was something like 30,000 voters per district, right? That's just 13 states. There weren't that many districts, and they would have about 30,000 people per district. And the House of Representatives kept getting bigger as they added more states and there were more people in the population, et cetera. And then in 1911, they finally capped it. So they said there were only going to be 435 members of the U.S. House of Representatives. And that took effect in 1913. So that was right when Woodrow Wilson was taking office. So again, that was mostly a pragmatic decision, right? Things were getting very big. They were running out of space for all these representatives. They didn't know how high it was potentially going to go. And obviously, the population has continued to get much, much bigger, you know, 200 million, 300 million, 318 million now. But in contrast, you know, we just saw the UK elections and they have basically a completely different sort of ratio, right? So we only have 435 representatives for our 318 million people. And then they have 650 seats for a significantly smaller population, right? So just, you know, 10, 15 million or something like that.
Do some division.
This is a pretty high ratio. It's not the highest in the world. The Indian parliament has, you know, I think something like over a million people per district, which is obviously pretty hard to get in touch with your representative, I would imagine. But, you know, Britain is sort of on the sort of polar opposite end of the scale, right? They've got one of the sort of lowest ratios of voters per MP. In England specifically, it varies by sort of region within the UK. In England specifically, the ratio was 71,858 as of 2011 on average, right? There in back in 2008, the sort of UK-wide one was something like 91,000 people. So let's just, you know, round it to like 90,000, 100,000, something like that, right? France, they have 577 members, and their ratio is 1 to 102,000, so that each legislator is representing 102,000 people, right? But in the United States, it varies a lot, right? They try to theoretically divide it as much as possible by, you know, equal size, but you can't really do that when you also have to divide it along state lines. And so the consequence of that is that on the low end, you've got two districts in Rhode Island that have about 400,000 people each. In terms of a state district, the smallest one is Wyoming. That's the entire state of Wyoming. That's about 575,000, something like that, people. And then on the very high end, Montana is just getting up to the split point, but it hasn't reached it yet, right? And they're at like about a million people per their one district, right? So they're one representative there. So the question that I want to ask today is, should the U.S. expand its House of Representatives? And more generically, what would be the consequence of doing something like that in terms of practical terms? So Nate, what is your sort of initial take on this before we get into kind of some of the thoughts that I was having on that?
It's an interesting idea. There are certainly districts where, you know, you sort of just have one guy where, and you're just covering a massive amount of area and not too many people, but, you know, it's sort of, you're a little disconnected from your actual constituents. Whereas, you know, if you have districts here in urban areas that are fairly small by comparison, where it's, you know, either potentially more people, but, you know, in a tiny area, or just so small that it's not comparable. But, it would be interesting to see what would happen, what the effects would be. I don't know if it would change a ton if without getting into like the specific districts that would be created and destroyed and whatnot. I'm all for making elections feel more local and getting more local just ideas and, you know, projects that are, you know, important to the community. And you might be more likely to actually get those done if you have a politician who's just more locally focused rather than just jetting around trying to fundraise all the time. So, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting idea. I don't know what effect it would have or whether it's at all practical, but...
Right. So, you know, one of the questions, because I was talking about this with Greg, our co-host, or sometimes co-host, I was talking about this with him last night, and, you know, his first question was, okay, well, wouldn't this make everyone sort of like hyper-partisan, because everyone would sort of fade into the sort of the mass of the parties, much the way they do in some, you know, the United Kingdom. I think that's probably one of the consequences that would happen, but I'm not sure that's necessarily a problem, as I'll get into in a second. But let's, you know, back up here. Think about what this would look like if you did something comparable to a UK or France, right? If you have 318 million people, that's going to be over 3,000 representatives, right? So that's a pretty significant jump in terms of, you know, 450 people, you know, 435 people or whatever, up to like 3,000, right? So this is now, at this point, we're not talking like realistic options probably here, because I don't think anyone's ever going to propose something like that. But just hypothetically, let's think about what some of the effects would be. So obviously in some places, like Nate said, you get a state like Wyoming, right? That's now five districts instead of one, and, you know, 100,000 people each. Might be easier to cover some of the territory, that kind of thing. But I think the immediate effect that you'd probably get here is, as Nate mentioned, you make those elections really local. And at that point, it's not about, you know, spending all your money on ad wars on, you know, very expensive airwaves to cover, you know, New York City or whatever, even though your district is just part of Manhattan, something like that, right? Because it's so small, right? Or you're, you know, got all these people in your district, you're never going to meet them, you're never going to have that opportunity to meet them, most of them won't ever meet you or get through to you. And the only way that anyone's ever going to really have substantive contact with their representative under the current system is usually like either they're really politically involved, right, so they're volunteering all the time, that kind of thing, or they have, you know, they're a donor basically, right? A significant donor, somebody, or, you know, a corporate owner, something like that. Somebody who has a lot of like influence to sort of break through all that noise. Because if you've got 700,000 people in your district, right? Any one given person, and they're like, you know, they're not going to make that much of a dent for that representative. And honestly, I mean, you can't even necessarily make an argument that they should, because if you're dealing with that kind of scale, 700,000, right? You know, it's very hard to gauge whether that's an outlier or someone who's just a very noisy crank who writes angry letters to the editorial page. Like, yeah. Right. So, but I think that what would happen if you had like 3,000 representatives or something like that, right? 100,000 people per district, thereabouts, right? People would, A, really get to meet their representative or talk to them quite a bit. B, they would have, you would genuinely be able to get a much better sense, I think, of how people in your district are feeling about any given issue, right? I think that that would be a much more important gauge. And I think that's something that happens in the UK as well, right? So yes, there's a much stronger party system there, but the actual, you know, sort of check and balance on that is that if your party makes a massively stupid decision or something like that, right, it's super unpopular in your district, you will know about it right away. And you will know that, okay, I can genuinely figure out how people in my district think about this and get a really good sense, not just, you know, oh, well, it's 700,000 people. Some of them agree, some of them don't. I have no idea what they actually think. So I think that that would be sort of a check on that. But I think the other thing that would happen is not only would you, from on the campaign trail, right, you'd actually get to meet people, yes, but you're sort of campaign would have to be about bigger ideas. I mean, you'd obviously have to be, you know, a personable candidate or whatever, but it would be a lot less, I think, about, you know, I'm just going to run my personal campaign. It's going to be all about me. I'm going to, you know, I'm the family values candidate. Do you like the dog on my campaign literature? Like all those sort of really superficial things, I think would start to fade a little bit, because when you have 435 people, right? That's 435 different individual personalized campaigns. If you go to 3,000, right, you've pretty much got to go on party basis at that point, because no one can possibly evaluate, you know, all the different, you know, people if they can barely keep track of anyone, right? So at that point, it becomes, I think, I would hope, a lot more about, okay, you know, I'm going to Congress to represent this sort of generalized platform, instead of, well, I'm going as a party of one who's going to randomly affiliate with one of the two major parties because that's how the system works. And I think that that would also help the parties, you know, yes, it would increase quote unquote polarization even more theoretically, but you would actually be able to have a much clearer choice. Because I think something that happens now is that if the national party, you know, whether it's the president or the speaker or whoever in Congress, you know, makes a huge mistake or something that's deeply unpopular in one area of the country, you then have the representative go home and say, well, I didn't support it, and that's not what I think, and, you know, this is just what the rest of the party wants, and I'm my own person, and, you know, that's okay to an extent, but then you get the problem of where people are like, well, I hate all of Congress, but I like my personal guy, right? We see that in polls constantly. Yeah. So
I think that's the plurality or even majority opinion most of the time, so...
Yeah, it's like, you know, something like 10 or 13% approval for Congress, but everyone personally really generally loves their representative. I mean, that's an exaggeration, but like in general, it's very easy to reelect people, not just because of something like gerrymandering, but also just because people genuinely like their incumbent, not that they've even necessarily met them, right? Sometimes it's just based on, you know, these TV ad wars. But I think that this would actually allow people, like, you would have to, yes, you would have to stand behind your party to some extent, right? Which I think would probably be a little bit better for kind of producing actual coherence in getting anything done in Washington, right? You could have, okay, this is the part, the majority party's agenda, not, you know, 200 people's different agendas, and this is the opposition's agenda, and then you have a genuine choice between the two. But also at the same time, if one of the parties makes a huge mistake or something like that, then there's a accountability at the local level where, you know, okay, this is going to doom me if I like stick with this, and then you can, you know, recall your leader or whatever. That's what they do in the UK. So that's like a potential effect as well, hypothetically. The other thing is, and this is US specific, like I said, 3,000, that's a lot of people. And you've got one of the overriding themes, I think you'd agree, in American history has been sectionalism. Do you think that in a system like this, the sort of two-party system, even if without changing any of the other mechanics of, you know, how we do elections in each district, would the two-party system basically start breaking up into regional parties?
I mean, possibly. We are sort of seeing greater divisions within, I mean, definitely the Republican Party, but I mean, that's sort of a thing that would potentially develop over, you know, if you were to do this, and then 30 years later, I wouldn't be surprised if there are more sectional parties. Yeah. But that would also require certain, you know, ideologies and issues to sort of co-align along regional lines. And that's not necessarily always going to happen, just because considering there's pretty diverse sort of areas where, you know, one state might be liberal, one state might be conservative, and they're going to be next to each other. So, yeah, I mean, it would potentially fundamentally change the political economy to the point where it's much more of a free market, just in terms of how many representatives there are. But the party system is pretty entrenched here, so it'd be kind of difficult to, you know, sort of splinter completely. So it would be tough to predict exactly what would happen. But you're right in that more representatives certainly means more of a potential for multiple parties.
Right. I mean, I was kind of thinking, like, the thing that made me think of it initially was just the outcome that we just saw in Britain, where, you know, and we didn't talk too much about this, but like, you know, all of Scotland, except for three districts, all voting for the SNP, which is essentially a regional party. And then the, you know, it was making me think, okay, well, there's like, obviously the Deep South has become almost entirely one block. Right, there would be those similar outliers like in Scotland, but for the most part, it's one block. New England, in the past couple of years, we've seen a couple election cycles where the Republicans were completely shut out from every single district in New England. So, you know, something like, you know, not necessarily a separatist party, but you might have like, you know, the New England party or something like that. That potentially could happen under a system like this. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. But then it was also making me think, you know, like the 1850s and leading up to the Civil War, right? That was sort of the like absolute peak tension of like everyone really identifying in a sectional manner rather than an ideological way. We, of course, then see in the 1860 election that it completely fragments. You've got the Southern Democrats, the Northern Democrats, the Constitutional Union Party, and the Republicans. And, you know, there were sort of people were voting along those sort of lines. And again, I don't know if this is like a good idea or not, because it could potentially, I guess, like kind of tear things apart. But I've been kind of getting frustrated with this idea of like, okay, it's really expensive to run all these campaigns, but there's nothing tying any of these campaigns together. It's just 435 people doing an army of one, and then they're supposed to get together and like work together. And so this whole talk about like quote unquote polarization, I mean, I don't know if it's actually partisan polarization so much as like the individuals are sorting themselves into like farther and farther apart from each other, but they're not necessarily like sorting with each other, right? They'll vote together, like usually against something, but we haven't seen like, you know, oh, this is the Democratic healthcare plan or something, right? I mean, with the health reform, that was like six different bills or something going through at one point, and they had to then merge down and figure out which one they were going to go with. So I'm just kind of like getting frustrated with how there doesn't seem to be any sort of coherence of what you're voting for. And I feel like that's really turning down, like it's producing or promoting a lot of the apathy that we've been seeing of people being like, I don't feel like I have a choice because I don't understand what the choices are.
Well, Bill, according to commercials for Senator Kelly Ayotte, bipartisanship is actually breaking out in Washington, and people are talking about working across the aisle. I mean, seriously, I'm hearing these commercials all the time, and obviously, I just find it very amusing when Republicans in liberal states sort of, like, portray themselves as either bipartisan, or there was the other one, I think it was, like, Tessay or someone who was like, as a gay man, blah, 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 and is like, hiding the fact that he's Republican, just throwing the gay thing out at the beginning, even doesn't talk about it in the rest of the like ad. It's just like, okay, I mean, we're not going to vote for you because you're gay, so you lost, but whatever. I mean, stop trying to pretend that you're something you're not. You're a Republican. The people in Massachusetts will vote for Republicans. Just don't pretend you're not a Republican, or like,
yeah,
spew this bipartisan, like, okay,
And he was running. He was running literally on the same actual ballot as Charlie Baker, who ended up winning as a Republican for governor in Massachusetts. Yeah, I mean, he could have, Tizay could have run. But yeah, no, I mean, the Republicans do that in the sort of when they're in the liberal states. And then I think, you know,
Democrats do that in Republican states. Right. To talk about their love of guns.
And, you know, we're both from Massachusetts, but Delaware folks, I think, will know. I mean, this is mostly going out to a Delaware audience on WVUD. You know, like that was a thing that was strange to me being down there when I was down there and working in the political sphere was the emphasis on moderation and bipartisanship as like a goal. And that's confusing to me. I understand the why people
instead
have that,
of a devil word.
Right. Yeah. Like, yeah, no, I'm running as an extremist. Like, no, it's like, I think, you know, there's a difference between being like, totally, you know, unreasonable and like being like, okay, well, I'm specifically running for a reason. Like I have, like, I'm not running to be the no party person. I'm not running to be a centrist. I'm running for a specific agenda. Like, I don't know, people, that seems, that sort of, you know, we should be more bipartisan or we should be more moderate does work in a lot of areas of the country. Not, it doesn't work in the sort of more hardline areas where things are, you know, much more aligned with one party or the other, because then party sort of unity is valued more. But there's like a large sort of middle band of the country. I mean that geographically, like mid-Atlantic, out in the Midwest, that kind of area, where you've got a lot of these areas where bipartisanship and moderation are seen as like important attributes or goals. And it's like, okay, well, that gets you elected, I guess. But then like, what does that person actually stand for? Cause that's not a platform. Yeah. That's just a, we should all work together. Like, yay.
Well, more my issue with the Richard Tesei ad was that he didn't even identify himself as a Republican. And I mean, at that point you just know, I mean, that's a blatant admission that you're not going to get elected if you're, you know, actually standing for your own party or own issues or whatever. So, I mean, that was that, but yeah, I mean, you do want to see people advocate bipartisanship if they're in a more moderate area, but at the same time, there is a certain danger of just getting sort of sucked into being, you know, person who's going to either try to compromise all the time, or it's tough to like actually have that platform, and it's also tough to sort of run on your accomplishments of, oh, I talked to the other guys, but if you didn't actually accomplish anything, so. Yeah, I mean, I think it is important, though, that people maintain this emphasis on bipartisanism, especially when it sort of was just eliminated over the past couple of years. Now, I would say that was mostly the fault of the Republicans, but, you know, we sort of, everyone needs to come together. But so we'll see what happens, whether, you know, Kelly's commercials are actually correct or they're sort of just posturing. Hopefully she gets voted out, but we'll see what happens there.
All right. Well, that is going to bring us to a close on this week's episode. Nate, thank you so much for joining me to talk about these ideas.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
And that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin. You can follow his work at the Digitized Ramblings of an 8-Bit Animal from 8BitAnimal.com. You can get additional commentary at ArsenalForDemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.